we've done it for you. And then on top of that, there's the business of generosity. Usually the World Bank is giving loans so that they can repay previous loans that the World Bank has already given. But in general, there's always sort of a moment of celebration of, go buy yourself something nice. But it's always taken back because it is a loan, and then there is the punch in the face. And that punch in the face comes from the economic structural adjustment, the opening yourself to the world market that comes as a prerequisite for World Bank loans. And if you want to see the consequences of that, if you want to see what happens when the World Bank makes its gift, then look no further than the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Look to Haiti. Haiti was the recipient of several World Bank loans. At the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti grew the majority of its own rice. There was the ecology, there was the know-how, there were systems of growing food within Haiti that worked very well indeed. And yet, as a result of people in Haiti demanding political change, the government was forced by President Ronald Reagan to accept a structural adjustment loan. And part of that loan meant that Haitian rice farmers had to compete on the open market with US rice farmers. But of course, there is no free market. US rice farmers are subsidized to the tune of $1 billion a year. And Haitian rice farmers were not allowed a single cent of subsidy. What you saw was something that was entirely predictable. Haitian rice farmers panicked, first of all, trying to make ends meet through farming, and then they moved to the cities where they became workers in the sweatshops that produce our clothing here in the United States. And that was compounded through the 1990s by Bill Clinton, who again imposed a structural adjustment policy. And that was compounded again in the 2000s by President Bush, who was part of a coup that unseated a democratically elected left-wing president. But that horror is compounded yet again because, of course, we saw that in Haiti in 2008, before the earthquake, Haiti was a disaster. And in 2008, we saw people in Haiti, if you watch the news here, people were engaged in food riots because the price of food had gone up. But those food riots were politically articulate demands for the return of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And they were also demands to be able to access the rice that was there in Haiti. But those bags of rice had the stars and stripes on them, and the words, "Gift of the People of the United States." Now, that's what makes it particularly horrific that we've sent Presidents Clinton and Bush as ambassadors of goodwill to Haiti. I mean, it's like sending the horsemen of the apocalypse to a peace conference. That horror is something that we have been responsible for. And so the question becomes, what do we do? How do we change that? How do we turn it around? And I see that I'm running very short of time. I am going to just take a few minutes to sort of nudge into questions to suggest ways in which we can fight back. Because if that's the international context, it seems as if we're arranged against some very big forces. It seems as if we're taking on forces of international capitalism, and that there's very little we can do. But in fact, precisely those forces that created, that the World Bank used to unleash its structural adjustment policies in developing countries, also created a resistance. And that resistance involves, was generated in part by numbers of farmers, of peasants, and of landless people getting together as part of something called La Via Campesina, the peasant way. And this is a movement that has over 150 million members around the world. I mean, here in the United States, there are members of La Via Campesina as part of the National Family Farm Coalition, for example. In Brazil, the MST, the Rural Landless Workers Movement, is driving forward the vision for agrarian change. In India, the Karnataka State Farmers Association has 20 million members in just one organization. And all of them are committed to a vision of what's called food sovereignty. Now, food sovereignty may sound, it has a sort of long definition, and I encourage you to go to Wikipedia to find that. But it has a couple of components. One is the idea that there should be democracy in our food system. And you'll notice that hourglass figure there has no democracy in it at all. The way that our markets and food were created were entirely undemocratic. The way that our markets, the way that people are being forced to eat, has nothing to do with democracy. It has everything to do with what it is that corporations provide. But bringing democracy to our food system requires transformations not only in the way that we govern, but in the kinds of technology that we need in order to grow our food. And so I want to sort of flash us forward. I want us to think about 2050. In 2050, there will be 9 billion people on Earth. And the question is how we will feed ourselves in 2050 when there are 9 billion people on Earth. Now, recently, there was a report written, oddly enough, funded in part by the World Bank. And this report has the snappy title of the International Agricultural Assessment on Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development. ISTAD, for short. These people did not go to acronym school. But what this report did was basically bring together 400 of the world's top agricultural scientists to discuss how it is that we were going to feed the world and what it is that was going to make it possible for us to feed the world. And they had, what they said was, well, look, the way that we feed the world today is hostage to fossil fuel, right? I mean, the way we farm today requires fertilizer, inorganic fertilizer, it requires pesticides, and inorganic fertilizer requires fossil fuel. And in the future, we won't have fossil fuel. Already, every American consumes 2,000 liters of oil equivalent every year in the manufacture of our food. And that fossil fuel, I mean, this is why we have fertilizer bombs, right? The fertilizer that goes into our food is incredibly energy dense. And we need other ways of farming, given that we've hit peak oil and we're in a period of climate change. We can't afford to feed the world through conventional industrial agriculture. And we won't have the cheap water either that conventional industrial agriculture requires. We need a revolution in the way that food works. And so what this report suggested was we need more urban and peri-urban farming. We need ways of farming that work with the fact that in 2050 most of us will be living in cities. We need ways of growing food that look like, a little bit like Havana right now. I mean, in Havana, 70% of the food that is grown in Havana that is eaten in Havana comes from Havana. 70% of the food in that city was grown in that city. And we will need those kinds of urban and peri-urban farming. And we will need agroecology. We will need ways of farming that are not about monoculture, about growing one thing over and over and over again, but a polyculture, a way of farming that is adaptable, a portfolio approach to farming, a way of farming that isn't about a single crop that is hostage to fortune, but a blend of crops that are able to ride out the ups and downs of a world that's ridden with climate change and with uncertainty. And this polyculture, this way of farming that is about planting crops that are good for the soil, planting crops that are good for fuel, planting crops that are good for fiber, plants that are good to eat, plants that are good for medicine, plants that attract beneficial insects. This agroecological approach isn't just about the technology. It's about the way that we govern that technology. Agroecology isn't just about a farming technique, it's about the democracy that surrounds that technique. It's a way in which a community owns and maintains its land. It's a way, in other words, of creating a new kind of commons, a new way for us to manage and share our resources that does away with the market. And these kinds of approaches are what we'll require in 2050. So if we need that in 2050, where do we start now? Well, we start with the food justice movement. We start with we start from where we are. We can't wish ourselves into some sort of utopia from which we take one simple step towards a perfectly sustainable economy. We have to start from where we are. We have to start from the struggles that already exist. We have to start with, as movements have discovered around the world, with what communities need. The food justice movement is old. I mean, the Black Panthers, for example, were an example of the food justice movement. The Black Panthers had a school meals program and a breakfast program that was precisely about catering to where people were at within their communities and building on that to broader kinds of political struggle. That is the kinds of wedding of politics, food, and ecology that I think we need to be carrying forward. And all of that is really about democracy. And I think this is the final point that I want to make. That our food system isn't democratic. Our food system is about selling us stuff. The way the food system that we have at the moment is the opposite of freedom. We are told that when we go to the supermarket, whatever we like is made for us, that our food is being made for us. But in every way that matters in our food system today, we are being made for our food. In every way that matters today in our food system, we are being transformed into the kinds of people living in the kinds of environment where, you know, where fast food, for example, becomes a vital lifeline. If you are unable to eat properly, if you are unable to afford to hold, to have healthcare and a stable home and a pension, you'll be running from one job to another and the only place that you can reasonably eat is off your lap. Then we are being transformed into the kinds of people who find the most ridiculous food palatable. Red Bull, for example. I have no moral high ground here. I mean, my dissertation was fueled by Red Bull. Think about the role that Red Bull plays in our society, right? I mean, it's a kind of drink that lets you carry on for one additional hour even though you're completely exhausted because you have been working and working and working, and Red Bull gives you an extra working hour. And yet, Red Bull becomes a necessity, Red Bull or coffee, whatever it is, in our society becomes a necessity because of the way that we structure our working lives, because of the way our cities are built, because of the way that we are exploited by capitalism. And yet, there's nothing normal about Red Bull. If you try and sort of explain to your great-grandparents what's inside Red Bull. Great-grandparent, I've got Red Bull here. It helps you stay awake. It's wonderful. Well, what's inside? Well, we've got sugar and caffeine and fizzy water, and then a number of amino acids that you'll most commonly find in your own urine. creatine, taurine, these are all cheaply found in your own wheat. And so if you explain to your grandparents that, in fact, what you were drinking was carbonated sugary water, caffeine, and piss, questions would be asked. Red Bull is a symptom, of course, of a much broader problem, the problem in which the way that we do live our lives is crafted in order to minimize the amount of exposure we have to food and to the world around us and to one another. And we are turned into these atomized consumers. And that has a real bearing on the kinds of politics we're capable of. Because in many ways, the kinds of democracy we've been exposed to isn't real democracy. It's a pale cousin, it's a poor cousin, consumer choice. When we choose between Coke or Pepsi, when we choose between Republican and Democrat, these are choices at the margin, but they're very different from real democracy. And if we are to have substantive change in our food system, then actually we will need real democracy. When I talk about real democracy, I'm talking more like the Athenian model of democracy. In Athens, there were no elections. In ancient Athens, where democracy was born, there were no elections. And instead, at the beginning of every year, 6,000 people were chosen at random by lottery to run the city. And they would run the city for a year, and then they would retire. And another 6,000 were chosen by lottery again. And that's what it is to be a Democrat. That's what it is to be a citizen. And we, in many ways, have been disempowered. We have been prevented from thinking of ourselves as powerful people, capable of running our own lives, running our cities, running our countries. Instead, we've been fed a diet of sort of sugary politics, politics light. And I think that if we are to have this kind of change, we are to have a sort of food revolution, then that means actually confronting the mechanisms of power that keep us down, but also realizing that we can be much more powerful than we are. But to do that, we need to realize that we are not consumers of democracy. We are its proprietors, and we have a lot of work to do. I'm going to leave it there, but I really want to take your questions, so thank you very much.